complaints afterwards that no one heard me in the back. So, I don't know. I'll do my best. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think I'm going to present a different kind of a talk tonight. I usually feel that when you do talk to an AA group, they have probably heard enough of the drinking story. And I always assume that in the audience there are some new members or relatively new members. We have a saying in AA, however, that the oldest sober member is the one that got up first this morning, because we're only a drink away from a drunk, and so on and so forth. Tonight, I'm going to talk about the profile of an alcoholic. Now, I know that all you are convinced that you're alcoholics, or you probably wouldn't be here. But sometimes a little refreshment, a little old jolt to the memory, bring it back, makes you think, stimulates a little bit, and after all, what does a speaker, his main object is to stimulate and make you think. Because I'm sure there's many out there that can tell me as much about alcoholism as I already know. However, I'm in the therapy end of alcoholics too, which is unimportant to you folks. We all know, I'm talking to new members now, that there's a physical, a mental, and a spiritual phase. There's a reason why we drink, but there's a better reason why we can't handle it. We wonder why we can't handle it. Well, actually, it stems from our emotions. And I know most AA members are good researchers. Boy, they read the books and they go through it, and it's terrific. But anyway, I'll assume that you don't know anything tonight. The definition of an emotion is a thought or an idea which manifests itself by an internal or external external change in the body. An emotion is a thought or an idea which manifests itself by an internal or external change in the body. Examples are anger, love. Anger, you don't feel good. It's a bad emotion. And if you don't, just think of seeing the angry person or yourself when you're angry. The thought can make the pulse beat faster, can make the face turn red. Internal manifestation, you know it. External manifestation, you also know it. Now, in a day, we go through thousands of these little emotions. Some good, some bad. Now, the whole crux of the matter is, how do we cope with these situations? Because we have built in us a thing called it's the innate desire to want what's wrong for me. Concupiscence. It's a good word. The innate desire to want what's wrong for me. This is built in every human being from the time we're little children. Our wants are foremost. We want to eat. We want our diapers changed. We want water. We want everything given to us. Unfortunately, we grow up the same way. The innate desire to want what is wrong for us. Now, does that mean that everything we want is wrong for us? Oh, no. Take eating. We've got to eat. Eating is good. But instead of having two pork chops, let's have four. They taste a little better. So we have four pork chops, high in cholesterol, usually fried. They're better that way, see? So the cholesterol level builds up in our bloodstream. We start getting early hardening of the arteries. We have high blood pressure. Then we get a coronary. Not that that's the cause of the coronary, because I'm up here to confuse you folks, too. Usually the cause of the coronary is an emotional thing, too. Combined with this body, the overweight, the 20 or 30 pounds that most of us in the United States carry around extra. I'm using these examples to show you that it's not always alcohol that's the culprit. Because it can be food, it can be overdoing of any good thing. Smoking, etc., etc. Whatever the good thing is, we will overdo it. It's human. So what do we have to learn? We have to learn self-control. You try to teach your children self-control, but most of us cannot control ourselves at all times, anyway. So that brings us into emotional maturity and emotional immaturity. We all know what emotional immaturity is. We just say that individual isn't growing up. He's just not growing up. He's just still a kid. But let's give some thought on emotional maturity. Now, I know you've all thought of it, as I have thought of it, but the best definition I can think of emotional maturity is the ability to give and to receive without conscious thought. Now, folks, that's a big order. The ability to give and to receive without conscious thought. And remember, we got this innate desire to want what is wrong for us. The pleasures, the feelings. We're looking for these gratifications, these emotional gratifications. I want to feel good. And even that you're now today, you're sober, and you wake up in the morning and those baby blues open up, the first person you think about is yourself, and don't deny it, because you're not human if you don't. You wake up in the morning, and you might have had a pain the day before in the left knee, and the first little thing you think about is, how's that knee? By golly, it's not too bad. Then you might think of your spouse, your wife lying next to you there, and you say, geez, I feel pretty good. Hey, honey, how do you feel? Fine. Get up and fix me some breakfast. Typical, isn't it? And then we try to raise our children. And think of the bringing up of your children. If there's anything wrong with your children, you made them that way. Not the companions, not the school, and certainly not their spiritual guidance. You made them that way. But also remember, men and wives, that it takes two to tangle. So cooperation has to be twofold. That's why any alcoholic that comes to AA should also drag his non-alcoholic wife. Unfortunately, my non-alcoholic wife can't stand me. She gets it all the time at home. No, the real truth is we had a new baby. Yeah, I'm not too old. Sobriety is wonderful. So, we'll get into some basic needs here, and I'll get into the steps of alcoholism. Not the steps as you folks know them. You folks know them, except for the new members, as recovery steps. I'm talking about the progress, getting there. How did we get there? Why are we drunks? And I'll come up with some amazing statistics. Statistics are wonderful things. You can play with them, make them sound good, or make them sound bad. Possibly the best definition of alcoholism that I can think of is it's a mental obsession coupled with a physical allergy. A mental obsession coupled with a physical allergy. That's why Uncle Joe, who lives in South Dakota on the back, they don't have 100-acre farms or 1,500-acre farms. On the back 1,500, drinks a quart and a half of whiskey every day. He's got the mental obsession, but he doesn't have the physical allergy. He eats his pound of bacon and his five eggs and goes out and does his day's work in the field. He burns up the caloric intake of the alcohol plus his food. He's as lean as a runner, a track man, and he's healthy. And this is true. There are people like that. Makes you sick. Us poor drunks, we want to do the same thing. But we got this physical allergy. Reminds me of a real quick story. I had a patient one time, and I think it was his 27th visit to the hospital from alcohol. I'll call him Joe. I don't remember his name. So Joe's lying in bed there, and he just got over the DTs and the illusions of grandeur. I guess he'd been to Europe twice and Monte Carlo five times in his last trip. And he never left the corner saloon or his room. So he was there. So about the third day, it takes about 48 hours. I'll take any drunk and I'll get him pretty dry in 48 hours, physically. So Joe came out of it and he says, well, tell me. And I kept telling him, in my opinion, he was an alcoholic. And he says, well, Doc, he says, how do you know I'm an alcoholic? What makes me an alcoholic? Boy, that's tough. Because you have to tell whether you're an alcoholic. I can't tell. Since I am one, I have a better insight, yes. My symptomatology is a little more clear cut. I know what these slobs are going through because I went through it. I'm no longer a slob. Note that. When they say remorse, I know what remorse means. When they say guilt, I really know what guilt means. So I understand them. So Joe says to me, I says, all right, Joe, it's like this. You got a mental obsession to drink. But there's something in your nervous system, back in your cerebral spinal connection with the brain, it acts like a strainer. And somehow this nervous system gets all, this strainer doesn't function too well, and you have this allergy, and the next thing you know, you don't eat, you get malnutrition, and your liver goes bad, and everything else. Do you understand this now? He looks up at me and says, yeah, Doc, fix my strainer. He had no intention of quitting drinking. All he wanted to do was be fixed so he could drink again. Well, in the back of our minds, if we're honest, every one of us wishes the same thing. We wish, hope, possibly even look forward to regaining our ability to drink. But we cannot do it. So, I really, truly believe that it's a mental obsession coupled with a physical allergy. Now you'll run across the drinker that says, but Doc, I don't get drunk every day. I drink once every 2 months. One drink will not hurt me. And I'll say, well, all right, fine. But weren't you away from home 5 days? Your wife told me you were. Yes, I was. And you were drunk, sloppy, in a motel, not alone. And the fellow said, yes, but I've gone 3 months and I've taken care of my business and I've made this and I've made that and I'm successful. Here's my answer to him. I'll say, all right. You're not powerless over alcohol at all times, and your life is not unmanageable at all times, but it is sometimes. If this doesn't fulfill the definition and the, you know, our membership card to get in here, I said, I don't know what. So if you're happier drinking, keep drinking, because sooner or later you won't be able to stop. There'll come a time that you'll be drinking every day. The bouts will become shorter and shorter and shorter. I'll get into this a little bit later, if I have time. But, so a person can be an alcoholic that only drinks once a year. Because if he is powerless over alcohol and his life becomes unmanageable, he fills the bill, if alcohol is the culprit. Now, does this mean to say that everybody who drinks too much is an alcoholic? No. We go right back to what I told you before. The guy that can drink a quart and a half a day, get up and go to work and all this other stuff, he doesn't fulfill everything. He's not an alcoholic. He might be a weak character, might have a couple character defects, but chances are that he is not a true blown alcoholic, because alcoholism is a disease. And to this day,
We don't know enough about it. We know the physiology and the biology, but there's a psychobiological factor to it. And, I've even had members of AA. Had a good friend of mine that came into AA. In the first meeting he went to, this friend of mine, he's a very good AA member now. He goes to meetings every week, two times a week. He's just as loyal as could be. But the day he came into AA and he sat at the first step table, and they said that you're a drink away from a drunk, you cannot take the first drink, and he had been dry about 5 days, had gotten out of the hospital, all sobered up. He went right out after that meeting, he went right to the bar and took one drink. He's never taken one since. And in his little fat mind, he feels that he said AA is wrong on that one point. But he's still sober, so I haven't argued with him. People like to mesmerize. People do not like to accept a given authority. People do not like to accept too much of a successful thing without really knowing it themselves. This comes back to this growth factor, this emotional maturity state. The ability to give and to receive is when you're emotionally mature. Now, does that mean I'm going to give you a gift or I'm going to give you $10? No. A true example of an emotionally mature person is a hero. One that would give his life without conscious thought. Now, everyone, to begin with, unless they are blessed far beyond the average, has to give these things conscious thought. Because we're not, structurally, we're not built that way. God wants us to struggle. He wants us to have it tough. And if there are any atheists in this group, you won't be atheists long because there's nothing left for you. See, there's nothing over here. You can profess it now. First of all, most atheists aren't atheists. They profess to be atheists. They're really not. They're agnostics. An atheist tries to prove the non-existence of God, and an agnostic says, it's too much for me. I don't understand it. It's just too great. Now, if you really get them head-to-head in a counseling session or across a cup of coffee and they're talking sense and they're not trying to get off too far off base, you can usually swing them around to where they'll say, I don't understand it, and that's final. But to sit out and try to prove the non-existence of God, they're pretty stupid. And a stupid person doesn't last too long because he's shunned. And he gets on the stupid conversations and stupid discussions, he's shunned. He just walks away. So, most people have to have a faith in a supernatural being, which is one of our steps. And, of course, we have to turn our life and our will over to this superior being. And that's a tough job, because I know a particular problem of my own that I had originally in the program was, what is God's will? How do I find God's will? Well, there's all kinds of answers to that. I don't know which one's right. Doing what is not wrong, that's a negative approach. Doing what is always right, that's a positive approach. Next thing you know, you belong on a podium in a church, preaching fire and brimstone and damnation for everything. So, I guess you gotta kind of work out your own what God's will is, but sooner or later it comes. I'm still talking to new members, by the way. But you do have to get a spiritual phase. Sometime in AA, you'll have what good old AAers call a spiritual experience. What that may be, what form it may take, I don't know. But it comes. Or maybe it's prayer. For years you've been praying and nothing seems to come from it. Most of the time, we are gimme prayers. We pray and we want. Give me that Cadillac. My old one's too dirty. Or give me this, give me that. We never think of gratitude or to be thankful for this. But so emotional maturity is the ability to give and to receive without conscious thought. And I read an article, oh, it's several years ago now, where this, when this Algerian situation cropped up and there was a soldier and he had his family with him and he went into this Algerian restaurant and somebody threw a grenade into the restaurant. And this young soldier, probably only 22, 23 years of age, dove on that, covered it with his body, it blew up, but no one was killed but him. Sure, he's a dead hero, but he was a hero, and he was emotionally mature. He did not give it conscious thought. You don't have that much time to give something conscious thought. If somebody drops a bomb in there, if someone dropped in here, I'd probably break the window. But I don't claim to be emotionally mature. Striving for it. Another example of emotional maturity, I think of myself because it strikes me so much. I can come home from a day's work. I have two boys, 9 and 10 years of age, and I'll be dead tired. Still plenty of daylight left, and they'll sit there tossing the football up and down, you know. They don't have to say anything. They usually slip on an old pair of pants, and out we go, boys, flipping the football. I've given myself without conscious thought, because this is true love. Now, I truly love my wife, but if she says put up the storm windows, man, I got to resent it. I mean, I always got something else to do. So I am not emotionally mature with my wife, but I am with my children in certain phases. Well, let's get down to some other things. First of all, can you hear me now? We have really four basic needs. Now, when we start talking about basic needs, the next part of this talk is going to get on to the profile of an alcoholic. I want to use a half hour gabbing. We need physical satisfaction. Now, physical satisfaction doesn't need too much explanation, does it? I mean, we got to eat, we got to sleep, we got to have our sex. We're big enough. What is it, 12? But somewhere along the line, we start needing this urge for physical satisfaction. About the first thing we do when we're a little baby, we want to eat. And we want to be warm. We want to be clothed, and so on and so forth. So I think that's kind of self-explanatory. Secondly, we need emotional. How do you like that for a doctor's writing, huh? Emotional security. I gotta do a little brag. Emotional security. Now, this doesn't mean financial security. Financial security may come into it because it satisfies the emotions. But you see, what people fail to realize is this power we're talking about. He created us all equal in the soul. But for some reason or other, he didn't give us all the same kind of drives, ambitions, and ability. If he did, there would be no variation in the intelligence quotient between human beings. It would all be the same. And then the particular struggle would not be evident today. You would not have an ideology such as communism and socialism and so on fighting one another. It'd be all the same. It'd be a very dull world. So what does he do? He creates some geniuses. He creates a pretty much average individual. He has allowed us to progress beyond thought. I mean, my gosh, we're out into space now. 14 and a half million miles, somebody said. So he didn't create us that way. Our soul. We're equal in our soul. But yet, abilities and drives vary. You meet a person that has ability, he doesn't utilize it. He just doesn't utilize it. So, We talk about this emotional security. The reason it's a need is we got to drive for this balance. And again, we're so selfish most of the time that if we don't have this emotional security, it's never our fault. Never that slob of a wife. She doesn't understand me. My goodness. To go home and listen to that yakking all the time, where I think if we, the man, I don't think the woman has a voice, comes in and approaches the situation a little different and he's a little more balanced, perhaps he can balance the female spouse. And it can work the other way too. So emotional security is a very difficult thing. That means that we have to handle every situation in a balanced manner. We have to have, somebody says, you got cancer. A truly emotionally balanced, secure person can take it. He can handle it. He said, so I have. I'll make the best of it. And then other people just go to pieces. Just go right to pieces. Ladies and gentlemen, I have far more non-alcoholic patients that come into my office with the cardinal symptom, I'm nervous. And I'll say, do you drink? Do you drink? Nope. Why are you nervous? I don't know. Well, you must. There's something making you nervous. Yeah, it's my hormones. See, a 45-year-old woman, it's her hormones. She reads Reader's Digest, and she's got to get a couple of shots, and Milltown, she'll be all right. See? But if she come in and said to me, I cannot cope with my daily situations. I'm emotionally upset. I'd say, you are a brain. Step over here and see some other patients with me. Because that is what they mean. And that's what they mean. Now, AA shows you a way to emotional security, emotional balance. But 99% of the people don't get into AA, do they? So we're the lucky ones. So emotional security is an effort. We have to really go for it. And along with this comes social status. We've got to have social status. I'm not going to dwell on this long because this is rather obvious. Social status, my goodness, we got to... Our country's getting so socialistic now that we're going to make Russia look sick someday. And I don't know whether I'm against it or for it. But what's the difference? We want social status. If some guy, and no offense to anybody that works in a factory, it's great. But some guy works down there and he's twisting bolt 9, he went through the 12th grade, he should have exactly what the guy that spent 8 or 10 years of school has. But that's the way some people think. It's a need. It's a basic need. And it's inevitable that we get that way. I don't know what it does to the masses, but to the individual, it grinds them. It just eats them. The jealousy, the envy, so on and so forth. But remember, God didn't make us all equal in mentality, physique, so on. Wouldn't we have some professional football teams if we were all equal? If everybody was equal physically, well, there wouldn't be any contest. We'd be a mass of humanity, gladiators fighting one another. So this comes down to, I've never met a human being that wasn't superior to me in something. And this is something that you've got to keep in the back of your mind. I've never met a human being that wasn't superior to me in something. Oh, what? Might be playing tiddlywinks. But they're superior in something. You keep this in mind, you begin to get a little humility. And humility is one thing we all lack, especially alcoholics. One of the cardinal character defects of an alcoholic. They not only carry a chip on their shoulder, they carry it on both of them. You know, reminds me of another true story. This Joe worked on the milk route, and he worked for this milk company for several years. So about every Friday night, he'd go into the bar and paycheck, and, man, he'd just whoop it up. He had several blackouts, but this one Monday morning, he showed up at work, and, my gosh, there's eight new faces at the employment office. So Joe went over to his truck, and he's looking around. His personnel manager comes out, and he says, "Hey, Joe, do you know those fellas?" Joe took a look at him. He says, "Right, but I never saw them before in my life." He says, "Well, you better know them. You hired them." Our fourth basic need. Oh, by the way, you pick up a psychology text, you'll find a million needs. But these, we'll kind of categorize them all in. Or you got to have achievements or mastery. Now, when anybody does something, of course, there's a few more things that you got to have. You have to have self-expression. That's why I like to talk. I really got self-expression. And then you like to have this achievement. You've got to have the self-satisfaction. If you're going to make a painting, how many painters paint for themselves? They don't. I mean, they'd be a little abnormal there, wouldn't they? They just painted and hid it. No. They want it hung in the public halls. They want it down at the art museum where thousands of people, anybody can see it. The achievement or mastery. Now, we get into perfectionism and all that. There's a book, that's it. Sobriety and Beyond. You don't have to listen to me talk. Read it sometime. It's fabulous. It tells us how to make decisions, how to live life, everything else. Terrific. But he doesn't talk about the basic needs. He does not talk about how we got here. It's what we do after we get there. Because words without action don't mean anything. And 90% of the failure in AA is because of lack of effort on the individual, not because of AA. Because of lack of effort on the individual. You tell them, see, I have to counsel these guys, these girls, and I'll say, "Will you please read? I don't like to read." So there's no effort. Effort put into it, and they stay status quo through the years, and they expect to go to meetings and pick everybody else's brains apart, and they're usually the worst people to deal with outside of AA also, because they get bigoted, they don't understand, and they don't want to understand. I was sitting at a first step table one night. And we got talking about resentment. And this fellow that I had seen around, now I love every AA member. If they come to a meeting, that's fine. That's all I care about. But I'm bringing out one point of lack of understanding and why there was a lack of understanding, because there was no effort put into it. This fellow, by the way, did not stay sober all the time. He slipped in and out, so on and so forth. So we got talking about resentments, and this fellow says, "I've never had any resentment." Well, obviously, we stopped the discussion right there, and I asked him a couple of definitions. And I said, "Do you know what a resentment is?" And he wasn't too sure. And we went on and explained that it was refeel and it was an emotional effect and so on. And sure enough, he had resentment. He really did. But 8-10 months, he was supposed to be working on it. He didn't have any. Well, wait a minute. Thank you. So, there are many more basic... These are the four basic needs. I got it. Now, let's talk about the next
I got to start moving here if I'm going to get into this other stuff. Let's talk about the effects, the actual effects of life. They really come down in another four. I don't know why he thinks some in fours. But the first one to talk about is guilt. And if there's ever a human being alive that has not been guilty of something, then he's abnormal. He's not thinking either. Fears. Very important effect. Fears. Now, when we get, usually an alcoholic will have unknown fears. They don't know what they fear. But sometimes an non-alcoholic, emotionally disturbed, nervous person will have fears, but they don't know how to cope with the fears. Again, it's an emotional situation. In effect. And then we come to our old buddy, resentment. Resentment or resentment. We better plural that one. Because resentment is just like eating breakfast. I mean, it can be little or it can be big. But we all get them. You can't help it. It's, again, the effect of our built-in, this innate desire to want what is wrong for me. Or, worded another way, the innate desire to always want what is not exactly right for me. You see, here's something. A person thinks over an action. The person says, I'm going to do this. This isn't wrong, so I'm going to go ahead and do it. But the person doesn't ask himself another question. Is this right? Is this right? Is this action or act or whatever I'm going to do right? You see, there's actually no wrong or evil in the world. Now, I'm getting into a little bit of philosophy. Philosophically, there's no such thing as evil. It's the absence of good. Because God did not create any evil. Everything was good. Haven't lost anybody, have I? We made evil. We did. This great human mind, manufactured under the goodness and likeness of God. We made evil, not God. God tolerates evil. But we created it. Resentment. The word is from Latin and Greek. I think the prefix is Greek. What's the difference? It means re-feel. Now, when you feel something, you definitely get an emotion. And a resentment is not a good emotion. Because it is the acid of the mind. The best way that I've ever found to explain resentment is that here's a vat. And this vat has the ability to manufacture acid. It needs stimuli, but very little. And it just automatically, innately, builds this acid. We have to come along in order to dilute the acid, we have to put alkali in. We have to buy it, feel it, find it, procure it. Some way we dilute this vat. The mind's the vat, resentment is the acid. The only alkali is gratitude. We have to find gratitude somewhere. So that's how we cope with resentment. Now, fourth and foremost, is anxiety or are anxieties. This is the culprit that makes us drink, makes us eat too much, makes us smoke too much. This is a thing that we all abuse, the reason we abuse it. Now, an anxiety can be almost anything. Now, we talk about living with our wives, and they holler, and they want you to do this, and they want you to do that. That's an irritation more than an anxiety. It doesn't create a true worry or a true concern. It's an irritation. But those little irritations, those little digs, let's call them, they can eventually create uncomfortableness, and you might run off and end up with something worse. But anxieties are the reason we drink. Because you know why we drink? Because we want anxiety relief. We want anxiety relief, and the best thing known to the human being is alcohol, and there's not a doctor that won't admit it. Alcohol is the best, the very best. It'll do whatever we want it to do. You come home at night and you're tired, you take one, you're a little relaxed, you take two, you're more relaxed, you take four, and on, and you can go to sleep. Forget the whole thing. Anxiety relief. Now, a normal, non-alcoholic individual will sit down and take four drinks, two drinks, one drink, who knows, the amount doesn't matter, and he takes the edge off of his anxiety. And by gosh, that's the best. The very best. Water didn't do a thing. So since we know that alcohol is the best anxiety release known to man, it's one of the problems of the recovered alcoholic. Now, you new members again, you're going to try to find some other anxiety release for this non-drinking. At first, it gets pretty rough. And perhaps you'll take up fishing, and boy, you'll fish like hell. Well, you overdo it, see? And the damn anxiety releases don't come like they should. And then you'll take up, if you're 20, you'll take up foot racing. You'll race like mad. And all you succeed to do is get physically tired. The anxiety releases are still there. So it's a struggle. And it's an awful struggle when you quit drinking and you know, especially when you get some jerk like me telling you that it is the best anxiety relief, that you got to believe that doctor, you know, we're infallible. Next to God. However, it is the best anxiety relief. First of all, it's one of the oldest drugs, medications, or foods, or whatever you want to call it, known to the human race. It is in almost all religious rituals. The Hebrews started glass of wine, friendship, bust the cup. The Catholic Church today still uses wine to change into the blood of Christ in their ritual of the Eucharist and the blood of Christ. I believe the Episcopalians still use wine. There are some religions that serve wine in their rituals. So if these clergy and these other people do it, must be pretty good, huh? It can't be all bad. Christ himself changed wine at the marriage of Cana. Correct? He changed the water into wine. And he made real good wine so everybody gets loaded. So, it's considered a part of social status today. It's considered very, very top-notch if you have the best booze in your house and you serve them. It's a social factor. People drink. It's accepted. And yet, statistically, each week we're proving that more accidents are caused with alcohol involved. Because we know it impairs judgment. How can you take a drug and stop the brain with it and not impair judgment? I'll bet you that if there's some AA alcoholics out there that haven't drank for just a short period already, they find themselves sharper in their thinking processes and so on, because it's one of the first things that comes back to it. The nerves kind of settle down a little bit. Except we have to seek some other anxiety relief. Now, actually, Dr. Jelinek was the foremost authority on the alcoholic. And he has broken down this particular chart. Statistically, he's worked on it for 25 or 30 years. Fantastic man. He's not a physician. He happens to be a physiologist. And I do admit that we kind of look down our noses at him a little bit. But he put all this effort into it, so we take what he's learned, and we're going to put it to use. We'll charge the patient for it, and he didn't. And you're getting a lot of free advice tonight. Will you get a bowl out there? There are four phases to alcoholism. First phase is kind of silly. It's the contact phase. You have to drink. I mean, somewhere it starts. So we do say that there is a contact phase. When and how that contact phase occurs, we're not always sure. But it's when I was up at University of Wisconsin this past July, or August, June, who cares? I took some postgraduate work, and I attended the Midwest Institute of Alcohol Studies. And most of them are therapists there. We got into this teenage drinking problem. We had a teenage panel and workshop. It was terrific. And we asked the teenagers what they thought of where the contact occurs. And it came out statistically that about 78% of all teenagers had contact, their first contact, with drinking in the home. And then there was another 15% that had their contact in somebody else's home. And one of the things that the teenagers resented, one of the things that the teenagers resented was the double standard. It was all right for the adults to drink, but not for me. And I'm 17, I want to drink. In non-drinking parents, there was a high percentage of non-drinking teenagers. In Wisconsin, they happen to have what they call a beer law. At the age of 18, the child, and I use the word child, can go to the police station, I believe, he goes to some agency, produces his birth certificate, and they give him a beer card, and he is allowed to buy beer. They have teenage beer parlors. The state of Wisconsin has tremendous problems with influx of other 18-year-olds coming into their state from the surrounding areas, you know, Chicago and so on. They bust into Milwaukee, and they can get beer at 18. The state of New York has just changed their law to 21. Now, the reason I'm going through this is because I'm talking about the contact phase. Does this increase numerically the number of alcoholics? No, it does not. Because one out of every 16 people that drink will become an alcoholic no matter where they get it. That's the statistics today in the United States. Percentages break down to about 6%. In other words, 6 people out of every 100 people that drink will become alcoholics. As to what phase of the alcoholism, we don't know. I made a real silly remark up there, and by gosh, I don't know. I said, well, maybe by letting these kids drink when they're 14 or 15, we'll get them into AA faster. And we had a judge up there, you know, boy, oh boy, oi. He says, who's that guy? He's still drunk. Gotta have some humor around here. So, the contact phase usually occurs in the home. Personally, it did in my home. And back to what the teenagers don't like, though, and we really delved into this question. We asked them why they wanted to drink. Now, I'm going to let you toy with that thought a minute, and just think in your mind, Why, I'm not going to ask for any answers, but why do you think a teenager wants to drink? I'll come back to it real quick, but just toy with the idea for a minute. Because contact can start somewhere. Contact phase is one of the definite phases of the alcoholic. The alcoholic drinks for, I mean, the teenager drinks for identification. Because the teenager is aiming for one thing. He wants to be an adult. What is one area that the teenager is not allowed to do? Drink. He can smoke. He can swim. He can bowl. Drive a car. Fly an airplane. He can do all these things. Terrific area. He's got the mentality and the marks and the courses. He gets into college. And then when he's 20 years 364 days old, 24 hours later, he's a man, and he can drink. Doesn't make sense, does it? Certainly, it does not make sense. My personal views on it are, it isn't exhilarating or decelerating the amount of alcoholism. What it is doing, though, is creating menaces behind the steering wheel of a car, which are pretty maniacal anyway. 16-year-old was on the street, almost as fast as I do. And two of us on the road, not right. So consequently, even though I know this is a little irrelevant to the whole topic and the whole thing, really it isn't, because we're getting into why they drink. Contact. So the contact phase, forget why they drink, because it starts somewhere. Now, the next phase of alcoholism, or let's reword it and say chronic alcohol addiction, is the prodromal phase. Now, the prodromal phase is an innocuous thing. First of all, we are drinking at a level. See? We're at a level. Now, when we hit this prodromal phase, and it's an imaginary thing, in some people, we never know when it hit us. There's an increase in tolerance to alcohol. An increase in tolerance. And somewhere in this prodromal phase, we'll hit our first blackout. We have an increase in tolerance, right here, and a first blackout. Now, this brings up a real nice ditty. I've had some of these drunks tell me that they've never had a blackout. You know, good solid AA. Why, I've never had a blackout. And I'll say, do you know what a blackout is? Yeah, that's when you go up, pass out, or you do this anything. A blackout is a partial amnesia without loss of consciousness. Intoxication may not be apparent. If it happens frequently after medium amounts of alcohol, the blackout foreshadows alcohol addiction. When the drinker begins to have drinks of which others do not know, and when he is preoccupied with whether there will be enough liquor at some occasions, he gives evidence that drinking means something else to him than the average drinker. For others, it is a custom or part of their diet. But for others, it becomes a drug. So a blackout is kind of a grayout. We've all had them. If you're a drunk, you had them. And that would go like not remembering that you put the car in the garage, or you left the bar at a certain time, and boom, and went to bed. Hung up your clothes. I never hung up clothes, but I used to put the car in the garage. You wake up in the morning, and you have a vague memory, and it's kind of a drifting back. That's a blackout. That's a blackout. Now, first of all, I forgot the time element here. The contact phase, now, this is only if you become an alcoholic, for God's sake.
You guys that want to keep drinking, keep drinking. No, I mean, you might be some non-alcoholic, you know. Could happen. I can't tell by looking at them yet.
Alan,
yeah. They're worse off than we are. 6 months to 5 years is the contract phase. And the prodromal phase runs... you know, get this straight also, folks. This doesn't have to hit exactly right. We can go 8 years and 2 days or something like that. The prodromal phase goes 5 to 8 years. Prodromal phase. Prodromal means preceding. You have prodromes of measles, prodromes of a cold. You also have prodromes in alcoholism. And then the next little step comes along is sneaking drinks. Now, sneaking drinks may not mean exactly to everyone the same thing. In other words, you go to a party and you know there's plenty of liquor there, so you're not too much concerned about whether you're going to get enough, but how fast. So, the prodrome alcoholic may not sneak in the way that most women drinkers do, or the cover drinker that we talk about, are going to. They don't have to sneak. The old man's at work. Pop the cupboard open. Have a short one, you know. But this other problem, you may be confronted with a boss at this party. So you're on your good behavior. You just make sure you get a triple shot in there, and you might bring it down real fast, and you get another one. In other words, it might not always mean that you're gulping, going in and out, and trying to get another drink. But you do sneak drinks. And then another phase, another step, is a preoccupation with drinking. Now, the preoccupation with drinking... Now, I know somebody sitting out there is going to say, well, I never had any of this. I don't have any preoccupation with drinking. This may be true. This prodromal phase. You do not have to have each one of these steps. Oh, no. Any one is diagnostic. So I got you there, haven't I? If you've had a blackout, you're in the prodromes of alcoholism. If you did not have a blackout but you're sneaking drinks, you're in the prodromes of alcoholism. If you did not have a blackout and did not sneak drinks, but you're preoccupied with drinking, you're in the prodromes of alcoholism. So any one. Boy, we're a ringer in there. But there is a preoccupation with drinking. Now, you see, I've brainwashed myself so much that I remember I had it. I had it. It went like this. Well, geez, I can't drink tomorrow because I got to go in there and cut some poor person's gallbladder out. And, I better not. And I wouldn't. I would not drink. But I thought about it. I had control. I didn't want to drink. But I said, I'll get out at 5 o'clock and then I can drink. So I was preoccupied with drinking because it came to my mind. And it didn't leave like it would an ordinary person. Then we come to the next one. The gulping of drinks. Now, gulping of drinks may not occur all the time because there's an availability factor with alcoholics. If they know that there's some booze around or they got it stacked somewhere, they may not gulp drinks. But this usually works out. The fella's going to a party. But before he gets there, he's going to have about 15 just to get warmed up. So he gets to the cocktail party. He's half-loaded anyway. He ain't going to gulp any drinks that night. He's got it. He's got the glow, and he can coast. But let's say he only has 5. And you've seen him. Maybe you've done it yourself. They always want to be the bartender. I was always behind the bar.
Sir, boys, have it.
And then back here, I had my jug, a great big one. And I hid that one because we ran out of booze. I had to have a little left. Gulping drinks. And then a real nice cardinal symptom, a cardinal step, is the avoidance of reference to drinking. Avoidance of reference to drinking. Oh, boy. I'm writing like a doctor now. The individual doesn't like you to refer to his drinking. You worry about your own. I'll worry about me. Then come more frequent blackouts. More frequent blackouts. Now, remember, you're not even an alcoholic yet. This is the program. Not an alcoholic yet. Now, if we get this individual here at this stage of the game, and we can get him into group therapy and into AA, we've got him. He's set right now. And by the way, there are more and more coming into AA programs that we stop. I sound like I did it all. Huh? But the AA has stopped, therapists have stopped. Two physicians that I know of that know anything about alcoholism. Seriously, doctors are the most uninformed of all. Because usually the case histories run like this. I was sick. My liver hurt. I had stomach trouble. Their anxieties were built up. And they couldn't. So I went to my doctor. I didn't have an ulcer. They spent $55 finding out what he didn't have. And here the guy was an alcoholic. And this great physician, trained up at the University of Michigan or Johns Hopkins, he didn't know. He says, well, I think I've got to take these pills. Cut your drinking down to 2 a day. That's the best one. Now, the next phase is called the basic phase. We've got the contact, the prodrome. Now we're going to talk about the basic phase of alcohol addiction. Somewhere in this individual, now if he stops here, I'm going to draw this imaginary line. If he stops here, he has more frequent blackouts, but he decides that's it. My anxieties aren't that bad, they're always. Or at this stage of the game, some people still have control. Some people will still say, the heavy drinkers, the party drinkers, you've all met them. High-pressure salesmen and, I can't think of too many examples, but they can stop it. They say, baloney, I've had 4 blackouts in the last 6 months. The next party I go to, I'm having 4 drinks, and they do it. See, they're not over this line yet. They're not into the crucial or basic phase yet. So, this they can stop. But most of them don't. We're talking of the 1 of the 16. 1 out of 16 people. The next thing is, this imaginary line is a loss of control. Now, loss of control. They're drunk. They're drunk. They either smash up their car, but they have no control. They insult everybody. Tell a boss he's nuts. And, I mean, it's terrible. That's loss of control. Not only emotional control, but they have no physical control. Fall down and do all this. Now, remember, ladies and gentlemen, a pass out is not a blackout. You've just anesthetized yourself. We've all passed out before we had blackouts. Because early back in here somewhere, we didn't have an increase in tolerance. And we drank until the bloodstream couldn't take any more with our particular physical tolerance, and we passed out.
Then we got the increase in tolerance, and we did not pass out. We had our first blackout, drinking drinks, preoccupation with drinking. We gulped them at times. We had an avoidance of the reference to drinking, and then we had more frequent blackouts and then a loss of control. So, then comes the real interesting and very humorous part of it, because all of us drunks will have at least one or two of the next series that I'm going through. Have I talked too long? Or something? This is about a... In a group therapy class, we go 4 hours on some of this stuff, but I've skipped the last. all right, we've lost control. Now, the frequency of the loss of control does not seem to be too important of a factor. If we've lost control and we stop and we revert back to that 2 to 3 drinks at a time, and if any of you believe that you can still control your drinking, go ahead and try it. Because the next stuff comes. Alibis. Now, when you start alibying for your drinking and you switch to vodka because you like the taste better, who are you lying to? You like good old whiskey. And you want all you can drink. But don't... I wasn't out last night. What are you talking about? I was down with the boys playing cards. You alibi. And that's why a lot of most alcoholics are real good liars. And even after they quit drinking, they still lie. I think it takes about 2 years before we learn how to tell the truth. It just comes out. And then you catch it. Then, along in here, you see, since we're not all alone in this world, there's always somebody bothering us. So then we get reproof by family. Now, this reproof can come from the wife, which it usually does, a mother, a sister, a priest, anybody that's close to us. We get reproof. And they don't accept it. It's just not the right thing to do. And we just don't like it. Well, this basic phase takes about 8 to 15 years. Basic, acute phase of alcoholism, crucial phase, got a lot of names. 6 to 5 years, and this is 5 to 8 for the prodromal. Basic, 8 to 15. Now, after we get this reproof by our family, and the wife tells us we're spending too much money, you don't do anything for the children, you haven't bought me a mink coat in 2 weeks, we get very extravagant. Extravagant. We start buying things. We got to make up for this thing. My goodness. Usually we're overindulgent to our children. And the poor little kids, they don't know what's going on. The old man's a slob one day, and he comes in, he's buying me a new bicycle the next. Holy man. But we do get extravagant. And we get extravagant when we're out. Spend more money, set up the bar. Now, usually non-alcoholics don't buy other people a whole bunch of drinks that they don't know. But an alcoholic will walk in a bar, and boy, does he want to live it up. He wants to be big shot, number one in that joint. You know those 8 guys, Joe? You just hired them. Then comes aggression. We get very aggressive. We're just against anybody that wants to help us. Especially the people that want to help us. Aggression. Now, we often talk about remorse, and an alcoholic knows what remorse is. And you will have remorse back in here. I mean, back in these phases, remorse will hit you. Especially if you lost your job or something. You know? But here we start getting a persistent remorse. persistent remorse or something's eating on you. You know, you just can't throw it off. The old lady's hollering too much. She's picking on me. It's her fault that I'm here. It's her fault that I'm doing everything else. Not mine. I swear to God I wouldn't drink if it wasn't for her. The aggression and the remorse kind of go together. And then comes the real neat part. The individual began to think about his drinking a little bit now, see? But he doesn't tell anybody about it, so he's going to try the water wagon. Sure as heck, somebody sitting out there says, I never tried the water wagon. You're crazy, that guy's nuts. But you thought of it. If you didn't do it, you thought of it. So we try the water wagon, and then we say, this is no good. And oddly enough, at this stage, in this particular phase, majority can do it. They can go on the water wagon. But then, after they realize that they can cope with this drinking, or drink two or three a day, like some great psychiatrist has told them, just drink two a day for a month and you're not an alcoholic. So the month's up, there's a change in the drinking pattern. Now this change may take various forms. It may run in a cycle. And the cycles vary with the individual. But there's a definite change in the drinking pattern. After this, the thought of going on a water wagon or definitely going on a water wagon, when they resume, they definitely have a change in drinking pattern. Now, just think over your own particular case, especially you new members. First, if you're not in this gang, well, heck, just think you might not have lost an evening after all. Bars stay open 2:30. But 2:00. But there's a change in the drinking pattern now. This is a variable thing. They'll say, well, I won't drink for a week. They put a time limit on it. And then Saturday, I'll get drunker in hell. I used to plan my drunk. Being a doctor, you got to look reasonably. You know, you got to shave, put a suit on, and all that. You can't do that when you're drunk. So I would say I'm going fishing for 3 days. I'd go fishing, but boy, I'd take a bottle with me. But there was a definite change in my drinking pattern, as there was or is in most others. Then after this change in drinking pattern, by the way, the sequence may not have to come like this. You may have this one come first and then this one come here. It doesn't have to come like that. Then we get a loss of friends. Now, a loss of friends, of course, we get a lot of new ones. I mean, we get so many, we gotta lose them. We can't handle all of them. Then, after the loss of friends, comes a loss of job. Now, the loss of job doesn't necessarily mean that the guy fired or kicked out. Now, we had a case where the guy had worked at this place for 25 years or some fantastic amount of time. And when we came to this part in this basic phase or crucial phase, you see, we're always looking for something to hit the counselor or the therapist, you know. I mean, the hostility is great. See, what your folks are getting tonight is not AA. This is what we call group therapy. This is the indoctrination to alcoholism, trying to prove to the individuals that they're alcoholic or let them think it through themselves. So the hostility is so great that the individual says, I got you there. I never lost a job. I've been in that job for 35 years. And boy, you know, we get pretty sharp after a while. See, how many men have been promoted ahead of you? 15. In other words, he didn't progress. He's sweeping the floor, he's not head floor sweeper.
There's always somebody going above them.
So it doesn't necessarily mean that you're out in the street and you've lost your job. I know a fireman, he's still a fireman, you know. Still polishing the engine. Where 15 guys that came in the station are now driving a truck, or they're captains or lieutenants or something like that. So on. So it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a loss of job. Now, up to this point, the drinker's always asking this question, how does my drinking affect my action? But when he starts having these job changes, he now says, how will my activities affect my drinking? In other words, work, family, responsibilities are starting to interfere with his drinking a little bit. He doesn't like it.